Hey everybody, good morning. Do you remember when I said that I had a bunch of episodes that I had recorded with other people in storage just in case I needed to use them? You know, like if I was writing my thesis all weekend instead of writing episodes for this show. I'm definitely going to pull one of those out of storage today. I spent this weekend working on my thesis rather than writing episodes, and that's kind of a bummer, but I did record this episode that you're about to hear with one of my best friends, and it is pretty fun. It's a little nerdier than maybe what we're used to because my friend is also a history person, as you will hear. So anyways, it's a little bit nerdy, but that's okay. So just an update for you, because I'm not going to have updates at the end. I just wanted to say thank you so much to everybody for listening. You guys are sincerely just the best ever. It continues to blow me away that so many of you listen to this show. Also, there's a new merch store you can follow. There's a link in my Instagram, or there's a pinned tweet on my Twitter profile. And frankly, I priced everything as low as it would let me, so I'm not even going to really make any profit if you buy anything from there. However, it is a great way to spread the word about this show, which is the very, very best thing that I could ever ask you to do. If you write a review or share the link to an episode on social media and tag me in it, anything like that is really the best way to grow the show. You know, word of mouth seems to be the most powerful way to, you know, get your podcast out there. So anything that you guys do to help spread the word is just absolutely so appreciated. So anyways, I was wondering, you know, maybe before I jump into the actual episode here, maybe do you guys want to hear my research project proposal, my thesis proposal? Just in case, you know, it's an update on something that I'm working on that is history related. It's a bit nerdier than what I usually do for the show, because as I have always said, this show is not a work of academic history, but I thought maybe it would be a cool way to keep you guys in the loop as to what I'm working on in my real life. And, you know, it's a little bit of content for you this morning, aside from, you know, the episode that I recorded with my friend. So how about I read my research project proposal real quick, and then we jump into the real episode. If you don't want to hear my nerdy history stuff, then, you know, skip ahead 3 or 4 minutes, because it'll probably take me a couple minutes to get through. So, okay, 1 second, let me pull it up. Okay, guys, here it is. In order to cover the vast chronological and topical demands of secondary education history standards, textbooks and curriculum often present the past through the lens of empire. While this methodology is generally effective at covering large expanses of time and space, it tends to exclude people on the margins. In American history, this is especially evident in the representation of Native Americans in curriculum. Significant scholarship has been conducted to analyze the historical accuracy by which Native Americans have been represented in secondary level American history textbooks, and further scholarship has been conducted to assess the mental and emotional effects of misrepresentation on students of Native origins. By decentralizing the historical narrative from that of empire and shifting it towards the interactions in borderlands and contested spaces, even more progress can be made toward fairly representing Native Americans and providing students with a more balanced and accurate understanding of America in its history. This research will specifically focus on interactions between Native Americans and colonists during America's colonial period, which is a window of time that spans from approximately 1492 to 1776. To the secondary student, there is nary a source as infallible as the lessons presented to them by their teachers and the words written in their textbooks. However, as history is an interpretive field, there exists the possibility for misrepresentation, historiographical error, bias, and ineffective methodologies. Due to the power endowed upon teachers by the nature of their position, such errors, if effectively relayed, can have lasting effects on their students' perception of the past and thereby the present, the consequences of which reach far beyond test scores. While it is unreasonable to assume that every history teacher in the United States adheres strictly to the material in their textbook, studying such books do allow researchers to develop an understanding of the expectations and methodologies that are recommended by industry professionals, and in the majority of cases, such expectations and methodologies are also approved by school districts and are aligned with state standards. To complete this research, a three-phased approach must be implemented. First, a solid historiography must be established, against which all other material will be contrasted. This will expose any misrepresentation, error, argumentative flaw, or bias in the material in question. A combination of primary and secondary sources will carefully be considered to achieve this goal. Second, an in-depth comparative analysis will be performed of some of the most popular and current secondary-level American history textbooks. This will establish an understanding of the current state of the field. It will also give us insight as to what is expected of history teachers and their students. And third, after establishing a solid historiography and understanding of contemporary material and expectations, a speculative projection will be explored in an effort to demonstrate how an emphasis on borderland studies will improve contemporary textbooks and provide students with a more reasonable and complete knowledge of American history. Okay, guys, so that is my nerdy proposal. That is an actual work of academic history, not like the rest of this show, which I have been pretty clear is not one of those, but anyways, guys, I'm going to stop now. We're going to jump into the episode, and I just, again, wanted to say thank you so much for listening. Hopefully, you know, this is week 6 out of 11, so, you know, there's a couple more episodes worth of time where I'm going to be writing my thesis, and maybe in a couple weeks I will have enough time to write a real episode, but if not, guess what? I've got some more episodes with guests in this storage unit. So, all right, guys, again, thank you. Here's the episode. I'll see you guys later. Okay, so today I'm joined by another one of my friends in real life. This is Will. So Sam, I named Sam the official All the People You Should Know science correspondent. So I think that you need to be the official history correspondent.
Sounds good to me.
Okay, because I'm not enough of a historian to be my own correspondent, so
I wouldn't label myself any more than you, but okay.
All right, so Will has volunteered to go first. Sam also volunteered to go first, so this is kind of a theme.
Yeah.
But, okay, so who'd you bring today?
I brought a man named Gaius Marius, and he was living during the Roman Republic. He is known for changing the Roman army into what we know of it today and its amazing glory, but also probably and most likely got the wheel started in its demise 100 years later. So it's a interesting dichotomy.
Okay, so this is we texted just briefly about this, and it makes me have it. Okay, so I should wait to hear your claim, but this is of particular interest to me because you say that he kind of started the wheels turning towards the demise of Rome. And there is kind of an interesting sort of historical debate about exactly what was the cause of Rome. And the most fascinating one and the most disturbing one that I jokingly texted to you was that there's a, for some reason, a few very notable historians that think that Rome was eventually toppled because people were gay.
Yeah. So
I'm assuming that that's not – I'm assuming he didn't set that into motion. But I was just wondering if you have read about that sort of debate at all, because it's very new to me. I only read about it for the first time a couple weeks ago.
Your text was the first time me hearing it, and I thought it was a total joke. But I could see people in, of today's context looking back at it and being saying, you know, that's really extreme. All of the heathen – nature is probably a bad idea, but back then I think a lot of people were polyamorous.
Yeah, and totally.
And they were just Greeks and Romans that just like to have fun, I guess.
Yeah, totally. Well, and one of the things that I I find interesting about this is that when I see it quoted or talked about, it's very like there's not a lot of explanation given.
Of course not.
I mean, obviously, the real reason is probably because the people that are suggesting this are homophobic. That's probably the obvious answer. But, like, the Romans didn't have a population problem, so it's not like they gayed themselves into not having enough people to run their society. I mean, you could argue that, like, living in a wholly hedonistic society is probably not healthy, but I don't think that it's going to make everything collapse, you know? So, like, I just didn't know if you had heard that as well, because the people that I have read it from specifically are Norman Cantor, and who wrote a really controversial book about the Middle Ages, and Roberto Di Matte, who in 2011 was the lead historian for the Italian National Archives or something. And then he was like, suggested that homosexuality destroyed the Roman Empire, and then he was very quickly not the lead historian anymore. So I was hoping that maybe you had some insight there, but this is a very new discussion for me, and it seems like it's probably just a bunch of people being skeeved out by the Romans having such prominent homosexuality in their culture, but like, I don't know. I haven't found any good reasons.
They could be looking at a religious perspective, because Christianity did make a huge rise around that time, and the empire did split because of who they wanted to worship and whether people should worship emperors as gods or not, and the Pope certainly did not like that.
So that's a good point. That's a good point.
So it could be, they could be taking that and just really leaning on the religion part.
Yeah, that's a good point. I want to find some more actual... I wish that either of the two people that I mentioned, who are probably the most notable historians to suggest that, had actually written about it, because especially Norman Cantor, in, I believe his book is called The Fall and Decline of Rome or something, not Edward Gibbon's The Decline and Fall of Rome. I think that he spoofed the title. Mm. But Norman Cantor was just like, straight up was like, the disease of homosexuality destroyed Rome. And I was like, I don't know if that's okay. That doesn't seem very, in my knowledge of historical scholarship, I don't think you're doing the work the right way.
Are his other works anti-homosexual?
He's a very controversial man.
Okay.
he is, so he wrote a book called, I totally derailed your thing, I'm sorry, but he wrote a book called Inventing the Middle Ages, which is all about how our perspective of the Middle Ages was shaped by a bunch of different historians and authors. And there's parts of it that are really, really interesting. He does not obey the rules of historical scholarship, which I'll talk about a little bit more later, but he has a lot of kind of historical scholarship mixed with personal recollections and opinions, and it's more contemporary nonfiction than actual, academia.
There's a lot of bias in there.
Yeah, a lot of bias and a lot of gossip. I mean, he just like slanders everybody. Even one of his friends that killed themselves, he was like, he probably did it because he was having a homosexual affair.
Oh man.
And I was like, dude, you're kind of a bad guy. But his books are really popular, so it's like, I don't know who... I mean, I guess it was buried in like the 13th chapter or something, but still, I read through that sentence. I had to do a review of it, and I was like, I all of a sudden feel very uncomfortable taking anything this guy says seriously. But anyways, so I will, I won't derail you further, but I was just curious.
Oh no. Yeah. That would be certainly something interesting to research, because, throwing homosexuality into a decline of a massive empire, the biggest that the ancient world ever saw, is definitely a statement.
I think it is. I mean, I've seen Twitter trolls say the same thing about America, but they're not professional historians.
That's true.
They might actually just be bots from Russia. Who knows?
Yeah. Well, this is probably a less controversial approach to why they declined.
Lovely. Okay.
But let's start it off. So Gaius Marius was a man who apparently was born poor and got into the nobility of Rome, but that is debatable, because Plutarch has a history that talks about his being born to a laborer, but apparently having enough money for him and his brother to be in the upper class. Hmm. So there's a discrepancy there.
Interesting.
But maybe it's just to humble the man in the histories back then than anything else.
Yeah, that's definitely possible. That's interesting. I always hate when I find those kinds of like contradictions. I recently, for a term paper, had to write about Luigi Galvani, who we'll be talking about at great lengths in a future episode. But that exact same thing happens, where it's like, was born to a working class family, but then another source is like, his dad was a goldsmith and they afforded to send him to university. So it's like, I just feel like at some point we should be able to come to like some kind of consensus. And I guess if I were an actual historian and could read Latin, we could probably figure it out to a better degree, but I'm not those things.
It takes away from leaders who actually did come from nothing and made themselves.
Exactly. You know, yeah.
In much powerful situations, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Gaius Marius, which was awesome, is that he very early on had to earn him a spot in the Senate himself, because he's considered a nuovo homo, a new man. Mm-hmm. He did not have a long lineage of family in there, so it was hard for him to get a spot and recognition.
Mm-hmm.
Right? He proved himself to be a pretty solid general and a pretty solid statesman, and eventually was able to gain a junior consul position in 107 BC. Up until this point, from Rome's start up until then, they relied on a very Greek fighting system, right? The military system, called the maniple. And it was good, but it showed signs of age by the time Gaius Marius was coming around. Okay. And on top of that, war had been Rome's thing.
Mm-hmm.
And land owning citizens did not want to be in the army anymore. They wanted to stay home.
Mm-hmm.
So they were starting to have some manpower issues, okay. Which is never a good thing if constant war is your main priority.
Yeah, no, you need drones to, you need drones to continue your forever wars.
Exactly. And there's no way, you know, Rome can compete with other people who are just taking slaves and field workers to fight.
Right. Right.
Up until this point, only citizens who owned land and could vote were part of the army.
Hmm.
Which is difficult in any economy,
right?
Because, you know, you can't have the money earners of every society just fighting a war, because then there's nothing's happening back home.
Right.
Right. And
the old World War II dilemma.
Yeah. Right. And, at the end of the war, you're going to have 15-year-olds carrying guns and you don't want that.
Right. Right.
But, you know. Gaius Marius was a smart man, and he was able to see that there needed to be some changes. And during his consulship, there was a big war against Jugurtha that Rome was having a lot of issues with. And this was also right after dealing with the Carthaginians and having, you know, a lot of foreign invaders on Roman soil, and then, you know, running around for 10 years on the peninsula and mm-hmm. burning everything they can, with Rome just watching it happen.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So there's had to be major need. Okay. So Gaius Marius makes some reforms and allows non-citizens and land-owning citizens to go into the army, and they could work for their citizenship and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
That bolstered how many people are going to be in it. Also gave us the word headcount, right?
Oh, okay. Interesting.
And then he also gave everyone equipment rather than every soldier having to supply their own.
Oh, that seems terribly inefficient.
Yeah. And then imagine everyone has their own set of armor and gear and sword and, you know, weapons and everything.
Yeah, it's weird.
On one battlefield.
Seems like it'd be hard to, like, make groups of people if you've got, like, Joe the Pitchfork Man next to, like, Dagger Pete.
Yeah. They have, like, eight specialities.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you can't, you know, if you're trying to fight a war with someone trying to control all of that, there's no way it's going to be effective.
Yeah, sounds horribly inefficient.
So on top of that, he changed how the entire Roman army was set up. Right, he invented the cohort system, which is funny because that word is thrown all around a lot these days.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, I wish that I never had to revive that word in my mind.
I know I don't ever want to use it again. But so basically, 80 men, each of them have an 8-man team. So there's 10 teams of 80. So breaking it down into the squad level up until, you know, grand army size, and we still use those breakdowns today. That's
interesting.
You know, it's very interesting.
Yeah. Very efficient.
Very efficient.
Yeah.
And you know, all these cohort systems, there's 10 cohorts in a full legion, mm-hmm. and the Roman legion is the best fighting force in the ancient world. And, you know,
yeah,
a lot of people can argue that fact.
Yeah.
You know, you can take, they're able to fight outnumbered. They're able to fight much larger armies and be successful.
Mm-hmm.
And while all still being able to be very organized and disciplined.
Right.
Right. Which is a good thing.
Yeah.
So that's the good thing that Gaius Marius did. He totally reshaped the entire army, mm-hmm. made sure that they can now be a good, flexible fighting force that can fight anything that they come across.
Yeah.
Including the phalanx and stuff like that.
Yeah. And that's kind of like a huge impact on history, because the Roman Legion is like, you know, anybody that has done any kind of study of Rome, even just like at a middle school level, knows about the Roman Legion. I mean, that's kind of like the thing that you probably imagine when you think about Rome is like, I mean, the big nerds probably think about the Senate, but like probably second in line, even for the big nerds, is like, oh yeah, the Roman Legion. Oh, that's cool, like a armor, big deal. And the cool weapons. Yeah. Cool armor, cool weapons. I actually, I was talking to my wife, a while ago about like what kind of books I used to check out from the library as a kid. And, I checked out every one of the like eyewitness history books, like a little dweeb, like all my friends were reading Harry Potter or whatever. And I was like, but look at the hilt of this saber. Right. Like, what a nerd.
As a kid, I read the Redwall series. So that's all the little,
oh, the mice.
The mice and stuff in medieval times.
Isn't there a Redwall video game that's coming out?
I have no idea.
Dude, I'm pretty sure there's like a big old MMO.
That would be game. Crazy.
I mean, I hope that that's a true memory that I have and not some sort of fever dream that I'm remembering. I'm pretty sure that's real, though.
Well, if it is, I might have to give it a try.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, but it's crazy. And then the only drawback being of the Legion is you had to be 5'5". And Romans were notoriously short, but if you had to be that height.
Tall boots.
Yeah. Real tall sandals.
Heels. Yeah. Little known fact, though, many Roman legionnaires were heels.
Pump up Birkenstocks, basically. You know? But no, so before Gaius Marius, you had only the nobility and the army, right? You had to be able to afford everything. Now, the poorest of farmers can join, who's not even a citizen, and get citizenship for his entire family lineage if he served 25 years. Mm. So he's making a lot of reforms that are very positive for Rome, but there's one big negative. So soldiers before the reforms were loyal and had to give an oath of loyalty to the emperor.
Mm-hmm.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Right? The consul, I should say. Mm-hmm. It's not the empire yet. Right? So the consul is the leader of Rome. Obviously, you're fighting for that person. Now, generals were responsible for paying, giving out all the equipment, and giving out land to his soldiers.
Mm.
So you're going to start seeing loyalties go from the consul to all the single-hand generals, right? So all the individual generals.
Okay, yeah. I see where this is going.
So this now is going to start creating a power shift that also creates a power vacuum in Rome.
I see.
Yeah.
So interesting.
During the reform times is also where you're going to start seeing the civil wars pop up.
Right.
So Gaius Marius was one of the first he had to fight to keep Rome together. He had to fight General Sulla. I don't know if you've heard that name before.
No.
He's just another general who had very loyal men who was outside of Rome and said, hey, you know what? I'm going to take the leadership position because there's no one else better than me.
Right.
So I'm going to create my own dictatorship.
Right.
Which is not a bad term in the Roman times.
Right.
It's
kind of like the Japanese rice kingdoms.
Yeah.
Right? Where they just like kept fighting over which little family would get the capital.
Yeah. Effectively, you created a massive republic that runs on warlords. Yeah. Okay, so this is...
sounds like a bad D&D setting.
Something. Right? Like everything just goes down and you're just in the middle of a RPG game that you have no idea what to do next.
Yeah. There's no objective. You're just like, everything's burning again.
Yep. Gotta fix everything again. So what you see now is you see hundreds of years of civil wars that are just based around generals wanting to take power, right. Generals who think the other general is a bad person to be in power,
right?
And they fight consistently until basically Caesar's assassination and Augustus Caesar or Octavian taking the emperorship and creating the Pax Romana.
Right.
But one man who wanted to do good ends up crippling the entire civilization.
That's
in a couple hundred years, though. You know, it's not immediate, but it's a long burn.
Yeah, that's a real mixed bag.
Yeah.
Like, great work there at first, but then in the end, like, that's not how you want things to turn out with your legacy.
Yeah, it's one of those unforeseen consequences that you're just like, oh, that's not a good idea.
Yeah,
and he was related to Caesar. Oh, so the whole family line is just destined for greatness and also really terrible things.
Wow, that's the unlucky family tree.
Yeah.
Well, dang, dude, that's awesome. So one of the things that I really enjoy about history as a study, And I'll get into it more here in a few minutes, but just because of the background of my education and the background of your education, I know not much about Rome at all. In fact, there's not a lot of geographic or chronologic subjects that I know a ton about.
Yeah.
And there's reasons for that, but anyways, I was really excited to have you come in because I always like to have a more like traditional historical perspective on things, and you are quite knowledgeable in all the areas that I'm quite deficient in.
Yeah, if I brought my notes, I could give you my sources, but
I never cite my sources.
Yeah,
which is a good transition.
Yeah, there you go.
So. I never cite my sources here because the rest of my life is citing sources ad nauseum. And so I use this as my getaway from endlessly citing source after source.
Chicago style certainly hurts the brain after a while.
Oh, it's better than all the other ones, but still.
Yeah.
No, the worst, I fell into this. I guess this is a good aside to fall into before I get started. But I fell into this kind of like intellectual brain loop where I had to find some primary sources on medieval monastic records. The primary source of a medieval monastic record is a medieval monastic record.
Yeah.
And you know what I can't read?
Latin?
Yeah, or old English or French or whatever it was.
Fancy cursive.
Fancy cursive in words that we don't use anymore. And so I was like stared at my assignment because I had to talk about these primary sources. I was like, I can't. Yeah. you gave me a job that I cannot complete. So I just sat there and I stared and I was like, okay, here's what the National Archive of France says about this piece of paper. But isn't that just a secondary source? The little write-up that the archive gives you, that's a secondary source, right?
Yeah.
I know. I had a bad time with it. But I guess that, you know, I did fine. Like, my grade was fine, but I was just like, I emailed my professor. It's like, I don't understand because I am incapable of reading any primary document of this variety. if you want me to find a primary document about something in English,
yeah,
I can handle that.
Yeah,
I can find you all sorts of primary sources, but yeah, old French, not gonna happen.
I know. When I was doing my thesis, I pulled a few sources that were in German, and I had to Google Translate, and that was not fun.
No,
because it's never right.
No, it's never right.
No, I had to do it for like 80 pages worth of reading because I wanted really to use this person's words on the floor, and it didn't work out very well.
That sounds absolutely miserable.
It was awful.
Speaking of thesis, we can talk about this off air later, but I've got so many textbooks on my kitchen table. They just came in, and I've got like so many. I'm going to break my table with how many books I ordered.
My car's back seat was full.
It's insane. I am.
I did 3 trips to the library. They didn't want to let me check it out all in one.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I wish that I could go to the library that I need to go to, but I can't.
Oh.
I know. So it's far. A, it's far away. B,
pandemic reasons.
Yeah, I think pandemic reasons. I don't think they're open.
That's a giant bummer.
It is a big bummer. There are digital libraries really good. Like, I've got...
Which library is this?
OSU's.
Oh, nice.
Yes, but they've got, like, I've got... through OSU, I've got access to like the JSTOR and EBSCO hosting.
Absolutely.
So like I've got a lot of stuff, but there's not anything quite as thrilling as going to the library and finding some obscure, boring book.
I may have a website for you. We'll talk later.
Ooh, yeah. Okay, so we better get into it. I'm going to get lost in talk. So this is by far going to be the most academic, historically academic thing I've ever talked about on this show.
Yay, academia.
Yeah, you know, I tried to keep things pretty fun and casual. Because that's what's interesting to most people. And there's probably going to be like 20 people out of the 3,000 people that listen to this show that are going to actually enjoy this. So just forewarning if you're listening. So Leopold von Ranke was a German historian born in 1795. He just missed the Enlightenment. And to literally any person who is seriously pursuing a history education, he is 100% going to come up in your coursework. He is a must know. to you, and he's 0% going to come up in any other subject field's coursework. He's a very niche character that plays a huge role in getting a history education.
I think I heard his name mentioned about 500 times.
At least.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Least.
Yeah.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications at TryLifeMD.com? We're now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
It's fun to put on jeans that you couldn't get into 6 months ago.
Every morning, I look forward to getting on the scale.
For anybody who's struggling with their weight, it's a godsend.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Least. Yeah. So he was raised by smarty pants Lutheran pastors and lawyers, which set him up to be a scholar kind of right out of the gate. He studied extensively at the University of Leipzig, where he focused on the classics and theology, and that's important to remember. I did say that he's a historian, but he didn't study history because history didn't exist. When you were studying history at the end of the Enlightenment, until Leopold von Ranke sort of revolutionized the field, you were only studying the past in reference to theology, philosophy, or the classics, which all of those have very distinct problems, because if you're only viewing the past through theology, you're probably reading the Bible, and while the listeners of my show know that I read the Bible, it is not 100% historically accurate. It's especially chronologically with the older books. And so
it's also a very narrow scope.
It is a narrow scope, and it is looking at the past through a very specific lens. And even if it's not inherently like maliciously biased, it is a very sort of narrow way to look at the past. Likewise, if you're looking at the past only through the classics, you're going to be reading about like centaurs and stuff, which exists, obviously. So before Leopold von Ranke came onto the scene, history wasn't an academic field. It was something that you kind of learned about through extension,
And I should note, though, that like there were quote unquote historians. I don't think that that word necessarily applies the same way. I think chroniclers is a better word for them. But you had like your Herodotus and Josephus, and you had people who dedicated a lot of their energy towards cataloging things that happened before them. And those are useful sources, but they were definitely not modern historians. They didn't have the same kind of research standards that we're familiar with today. They pretty much just took the they took the general consensus of how things happened, wrote it down, and then that was the only source of anything for, you know, whatever had happened before them. And I also want to note that I'm only speaking of Western historical studies because I don't know enough about Middle Eastern historical studies or Far Eastern historical studies to really give a big history on those. I know that during the formation of the Quran, like, those scholars were very studious. And so I'm sure that there are probably other figures that formed like a more professional, you know, sort of field of study around history then. But I just don't know enough about it to actually give any thoughts about it.
There's certainly a huge intellectual community and society in the Middle East.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, a lot of those sources I can't read.
Yeah, exactly.
And a lot of Western historians cannot read.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and one of the things that I've been kind of surprised by is that, like, in getting an education here in the U.S., there is really not a lot of study into the Middle East or Asia, just ever, or Africa. There's I know next to nothing about any of those places.
Yeah, there's only a few classes that were given, and I made sure to take a few of them.
Yeah.
When I was in college, but, you know, they're few and far between. And they're only based on major events that happened in the East.
Yeah, it's true. And, you know, even further, I guess, in more of an academic sense, they're formed by, and usually, because not always, but those classes that I've noticed are usually formed by and sculpted by Western scholars and professors, and they curate a lot of Western sources on Eastern subjects, mm-hmm. which definitely affects the way that we perceive it and understand it. So for all I know, the Middle East or Asia could have had much more developed historical study, but the Western historical, the situation of historical study in the Western world at the time didn't exist, except for through the lens of very specific other fields. So he goes to school, he graduates, his particular fields, like I said, were the classics and theology, and after his graduation, he began teaching at Frederick's Gymnasium in Frankfurt, and during this time, he decided to put forth an actual intentional effort to make historical study its own field. But there's a couple problems with his method. So the first one that we need to probably bring up right away is that he was very religious. Obviously, he was raised by Smarty Pants Lutherans and himself was a Smarty Pants Lutheran. So his main motive of making history its own field of study was to observe the hand of God in the past, which is obviously doesn't stand up to modern academic standards, but also played a really important role in the development of his theory in kind of a weird way. In kind of a weird way, it works a little bit backwards, which we'll get to here at the end. So he sets off with the mission of being able to, like, go through the past and highlight all the things that God has done through, you know, through the things that have happened. So in this effort, he ends up writing a big book called Histories of the Latin and Teutonic Peoples from 1494 to 1514, which is a very specific date range, and I'm fine with it. Yeah. Every historical book is a weirdly specific date range. it's never just like, here's all the stuff you need to know about the Teutonic people. It's like the Teutonic people and their food from 9/11 to 9/18.
Yeah, but, you know, if you're getting a hyper-specific book like that, you're probably going to find something decent.
Probably.
And something good in there.
And I think it gives you clout. The more dates, the more dates in the title, the more clout you get.
No, there's a specific year range. I know exactly everything that happened.
Exactly. So the this book, in terms of information, is basically useless to us now. Scholars don't use it as a source really on much. But what it did do is it introduced the use of what we know today as primary sources. Before his book, The Histories of the Latin and Teutonic Peoples from 1494 to 1514, people never really thought to use things like memoirs or diaries or personal correspondences or eyewitness accounts in their scholarship. They would sometimes cite other authors. Sometimes they would just write a bunch of stuff and assume that because they were smarty pants people, everybody would just trust them. So a lot of old, you know, old scholarship or old works of, you know, research or whatever, are just a guy writing a bunch of stuff with no sources, no citations. Sometimes, you know, like I said, they would cite other authors or other researchers or whatever. But Leopold von Ranke was the first person to actually say that we need to see the past as it actually happened. And that is a quote of his that I have poached on this show a bunch. It's a quote of his that I have poached in many papers.
Yeah.
For many reasons.
It's a good quote.
It's a great quote. And it is, you can point to that quote basically as being the birth of modern historical study. Because before that it was, you know, like we talked about earlier, the past as God did it, or the past according to Plato or whatever. So von Ranke is the first person to say, okay, no, we have to look at the past as it actually happened. And I'm going to jump ahead just a little bit in my notes because I kind of skipped around. But so his work, I'm skipping through a lot of his career. So basically, he ended up being a professor at the University of Berlin, and he was a professor there for about 50 years. And in his time there, he basically invented history as we know it today as a subject. Because when you say history, you can mean things that happened in the past, but you can also mean history as in the verb, the field of study that people do. You know, it is a thing that people do, as well as just a subject of information. So he invented history, the study, basically in the 50 years that he was a professor. In fact, before he was a professor, nobody really gave lectures in the way that we're familiar with today. So if you've ever gone to a college class and you sit in a kind of amphitheater looking classroom and a guy has a PowerPoint and talks at you for 45 minutes.
Makes you do the clicker thing.
Yeah, exactly. So if you've ever done that, Leopold von Ranke was the first person to introduce that style of teaching. And also, the other thing that he established is, I didn't realize this because it never came up in the class that I read about him in, but one of the things that he revolutionized was, like, before him, so universities today have to do a couple of things that generally people don't really know about to maintain their status as an actual university. One of them is offer tenure to professors. That is actually something that they have to do in order to keep their status. The second is their professors actually have to be working in the profession in addition to being a teacher. So, like, teaching is kind of the side gig, actually, because research projects and things like that are what bring the university money a lot of the time, unless you're really good at football, and then that brings you money. So that is something that he did in his time as a professor, is he established, like, no, I can be a teacher here and also write a bunch of stuff for, you know, these different principalities, because he was made the royal historiographer of some region of Germany or something.
Man, that's a big title.
It is. Yeah. He was the royal historiographer to somebody. It wasn't quite Germany. Anybody that's familiar with timelines probably caught on right away, but, you know, he's lecturing in what is currently Berlin in the early to mid 1800s. So whatever empire it was.
West Prussia.
Yeah. Prussia, I guess probably towards the end of his life and career, it probably was regular Germany, but not even.
No, because right before World War I was Weimar Republic.
Gross.
Yeah, that's...
So he lived in Berlin, regardless of whatever empire Berlin was at that time, but he taught in Berlin for over 50 years. So he probably went through a couple of very big political shifts in his time there, but he never really left. He just stayed at the university and taught. But at various times, he was kind of used as a consultant, right? So like other people would come to him and they would use his archives. He had collected himself an archive of 25,000 books, which now resides at the University of Syracuse. You can go see the Leopold von Ranke Library if you have special permission. So
I need to get special permission.
I know. I want to go visit it. Not that I can read any of it because it's probably all in Latin German. And Greek and German, but so he established not only the field of history as it is, but also the profession of being a professor, basically. I mean, because pretty much every professor, no matter what subject, has to follow those kind of basic rules. Mm-hmm. So another foundation of historical study that he invented is empiricism. Von Ranke wanted history to be as much like science as possible, and he disagreed with pretty much every popular opinion on the subject at the time and argued that there's not really one kind of one-size-fits-all method to studying the past. Instead, he argues that each historical subject must be approached with diligent research in its own special, unique way to the best of the researcher's ability, which is quite similar to what we have to do today.
That goes out to all the revisionist historians. hope I don't anger any of your listeners.
I don't think you will. So in the same lines of his belief that history should be viewed with complete empiricism, and I mean complete empiricism, he was like very adamant that no subjectivity be allowed.
Strict construction, basically.
To just like straight up only the facts, barely any actual interpretation. And that has actually got some criticism by 19th and 20th century scholars because, I mean, for various reasons, things evolve. The other thing that he established that is kind of a staple of historical study is that he said every generation is equidistant from God. So not only should the past be viewed without any kind of bias or without any kind of frame and in a sort of sterile scientific way, but he also argues that as much as is possible, history should be viewed outside the realms of space and time. That you should be studying, you know, something that happened in 4 BC in the same exact way as you should be studying something that happened 50 years ago, which is another one of those.
That causes issues too.
It causes issues, but it's also, you know, it's kind of a given. Like if I'm reading about, you know, shoe cobblers in 1600 Italy, you know, I'm going to want to get all the context that I can. And that's really what came out of that was the need for context, because if you're viewing something outside of space and time and you're trying to isolate it in its own sort of area, today we just call it context. But to him, you know, before he said that, nobody used context. They just said, that's the way that it was for the Greeks. That's the way that it is. How I'm going to write it. It's like, no, there's probably some stuff you should know first about whatever they were writing.
Right.
And so his career was just like completely revolutionary. Another quote that I have poached this quote maybe 5,000 times, but he says that history should be viewed without modern condescension, which I think is which is great. So that is only slightly different, and I'm trying to make this as not boring and academic-y as possible. So the last three quotes that he's given that we've just talked about, he establishes that history should be viewed empirically without bias. It should be viewed outside of time and space in its own context, and that it should be viewed without any kind of modern expectation or, you know, moral standards. Right. So without any kind of tainting from the modern perspective, it should be like plucked like a scientific sample, right?
Yeah.
Which is really, it's hard and frankly most people would argue that it's impossible that his method set up a standard that is far too high to actually achieve. But what it did was it established a brand new field of study where there had not been one previously.
Yeah. And we know today that you can't put a specific historical event in a vacuum and look at it.
Yeah.
But, you know, we couldn't. It's real hard to get away from the fact that a lot of people today don't know what historical context is either.
Exactly. Right? Yeah.
So you can't talk about a very hot topic or a very controversial issue that happened 200 years ago in today's perspective, because we don't know how people thought and lived back then.
Exactly. And you can try, you know, you can try to get the right context, but there has to be a balance. You know, you can't go without any context, but also at the same time, you're never going to have enough context to see things without any kind of bias.
Yeah, because anybody would grow up in a totally different mind frame, you know, situation or anything like that. There's no way that you can compare those things back to back.
Absolutely.
Or side to side.
Absolutely. And to get really, really boring and deep and historian-ish about it, you know, if I'm researching something today, I'm using archives. And, you know, if I'm reading about women in Venice in, you know, let's say 1100, it could be an anachronism. Anyways, if I'm reading about women in ancient Venice and I'm using court documents that are in an archive, you know what women weren't allowed to do? Be in court. So I'm not going to learn anything valuable about the lives of women if I'm using sources that only come from a space where they weren't allowed to go.
Yeah.
So it's just, you know, not only do we have our own modern biases, but also just the manner by which things have been preserved sometimes just makes it very difficult to learn about a specific subject. Also, you know, some people, I read this really interesting article for one of my classes that was like this lady who goes through and she does like, she writes for academic journals. So it's not that interesting, but it was interesting for an academic journal. But basically she goes through old like Victorian era court records and finds like true crime cases to like turn into like I don't think she has a podcast or anything, but like she writes these kind of like saucy sort of academic articles about true crime that she's found hidden away in an archive. But the problem that she found is that sometimes the person that's writing something that knows it's going to get archived sometimes either juices the story because they want to wrongfully convict a person and they need it to look saucy when it gets submitted, you know, or they underreport a fact because, you know, they're a bad note taker, or maybe they have some kind of actual intention of taking a bad note. And so we use archives as a primary source, but at the same time, not just because it comes from an archive doesn't make it reliable. You can write anything and put it in an archive, really. So I think that at a certain point when you're doing actual academic history, and I've said many, many times on this show that this is not a work of academic history. This is what nerds call a synthesis. I am synthesizing a bunch of different sources into one thing that is enjoyable, but not, you know, it's not going to get peer reviewed. Yeah. But that's one of the things that you can get hung up on doing academic history is you can find yourself in a pit of despair of trying to find whether your source is accurate, or because I'm using this person's eyewitness account. How do I know that person saw what they actually saw? You can't prove it. You just have to figure out whether you can trust them or not based on other eyewitness accounts or other sources. So it's kind of this, you know, never ending spiral. But without Leopold von Ranke, we wouldn't have any of it anyway. So I guess I'm grateful that he did what he did.
The first version of something is never going to be perfect either.
Exactly. And so
there's always room to grow.
Exactly. And historians like E.H. Carr, especially, I wrote his name down because he's the one that I recognized. I've read some E.H. Carr. I don't remember what. Something about historiography, I think. But he argues that that Ranke's method is far too rigid, which I agree with. He argues that it is boring, which is also probably true. And he argues that the role of historian as scientist is not really valid anymore. And I think that there's a lot of I think that there's a lot of weight to that. And I think that there is an ongoing discussion about what the role of the historian is now.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's a fascinating topic. I think it's probably a little bit too boring to get into here, but I did want to talk briefly about, so within the realms of history, there are many, many different methodologies and fields of study. So what I started to say earlier, but I stopped myself because I wanted to save it till the end. I have taken some very particular courses that have shaped my interest in a way that my areas of, I don't want to say expertise because I'm not an expert, and I don't want to say specialty because I'm not a professional, but the areas that I know the most about are anachronistic, or they're not chronological, they're not geographical. I don't know a bunch about, like, you know, the German Empire or, you know, but any kind of dynasty in China or anything. Like, I don't really know a ton about the greater historical timeline. Most of the historical classes I have taken have been in a field of study that I think you could call the history of thought.
Mm-hmm.
I've taken some courses on religion and social movements, philosophy of history, like kind of more abstract historical concepts. Classes about, you know, the professionalization of history. I've taken a couple of those. So at this point, I know a bunch about the study of history and, you know, the history of human perception of the world, but I don't really know too much about any one thing. So I was wondering if you had to pick an area or two, a field of study or two that you could say is your area of expertise, what would they be?
Well, I as well did have a lot of abstract concepts in university, but I did try to branch out and not really focus on one concept either.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Cause I took a few Eastern courses, certainly American courses, a lot of it focused on military stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But my focus, if I were to pick some of the focus, I would be very into Middle Age, Northern Europe.
Okay.
Okay, so, you know, Viking Age and, mm-hmm. you know, Teutonic and all that good stuff, right?
Your people.
My people. I don't know that. Suppose it, right?
You do 23andMe.
I need to.
I would do one, but I've got my whole family tree. I know how white and boring it is.
Yeah. That's the new Weird Al song, right?
It should be. Mm. Actually, I think it is, isn't it? Well, no, white nerdy. Yeah, yeah.
The other one I'd be super into is Far East, around the time of Western Renaissance Enlightenment.
So, oh, okay.
1700s,
right.
Korea and Japan.
Right.
I took a lot of the older empire courses for Japan, mm-hmm. and things like that. And
right.
They're entire society structure, war society, Bushido code, everything like that is so intriguing, especially when you read about it from somebody who went and spent time in Japan and actually read the real sources.
Right.
It's
right.
crazy.
Yeah. I can only imagine.
I mean, Rome called tribes outside of their places barbarians,
uh-huh.
right? Outside of their borders.
Right.
But the warrior societies of Sparta and in Rome don't have anything on Japanese society. It is so tiered, structured, strict.
That's crazy.
But brutal and non-forgiving. It is, yeah.
That's cool. That's awesome. I always kind of, I'm recording this in the past. So if you're listening to this, I have already released a couple of other episodes. So in the past, in my real life, it was yesterday or Monday. But whenever you're listening to this, it was in the past, and hopefully you've already listened to the episode. But I just did an episode on Mad Jack Churchill, who's a crazy, crazy man.
An icon.
An absolute icon. I think the kids would call him a mood.
Yeah.
He's a whole mood. But one of the things that it made me realize is that, like, I really am not into military history. Like, I know the general chronology of like the big wars. But like when I read actual military historians, it's so impressive, the knowledge that they can bring up about like somebody's rank or like what platoon was where and when and why that matters to the rest of, like, it's like playing five games of chess at once, I think. The same thing with political history, too. Like when I read an actual work of political history and somebody is like taking the time to read a bunch of obscure legislation
and to make all the connections
and to make all the, it's just like, that is a type of thought that I am not quite capable of. I guess if I had to summarize my historical interest in a way that is the least pretentious, I think I would probably say I'm interested the most in the human experience.
Yeah.
Not
a social historian.
Yes. Yeah. A social historian. Yeah. In our perception of history as a field and in general. Social historian, history of private life, I'm pretty into that.
It is definitely really cool to see how lives are affected by major changes.
It is. Too. Yeah, you totally. Know? And just people's general attitudes. I love reading I'll have to make sure that I release these in time, but one of the things that really struck me was I was reading about Luigi Galvani, who did a bunch of experiments that inspired Mary Shelley to write Frankenstein. And Frankenstein was so shocking that it actually scared people out of the Enlightenment attitude and back into a religious attitude, because they're like, if this is possible, I'm so scared about everything.
Absolutely.
And so just things like that, where it's like there are certain events in history that just change people's attitude so much and so greatly that it changes, you know, the way that societies approach things, which I think is so interesting.
What interests me and also entertains me is just to think of how an everyday person who might just be walking by the grandstand of an emperor talking, mm-hmm. and he said, "We're going to start a new war against the next civilization next door," and just want to hear the gut reactions of the people.
Yeah.
Right. It's going to be hilarious because you've seen political speeches or really cringy things on TV, and you see people immediately react. Imagine how that would be for a civilization that has been losing wars after war after war, and they just say, "I'm going to invade this person next."
Yeah, right?
That would be, and then you have to be happy because it's the emperor. And if you frown, you get your head cut off. I'd like to see that.
Sounds terrible.
Reactions.
That sounds terrible. I just saw a cringy thing on Reddit today. It was bad.
Oh.
This terrible woman said some things that she shouldn't have said in a bagel shop, and people had a reaction.
Is that the one that got tackled?
I don't know.
Okay.
I stopped watching halfway through because it made me so physically uncomfortable.
Okay.
She was saying some very terrible, very racially motivated things. And as soon as she started saying things, the entire store was like, no, stop. And I didn't even make it through the whole video. I hope she got tackled. Frankly, I saw a female security guard in the background, and she could have got done with a tackle or two. Oh, it was rough. Anyways, okay, so I'm going to call the episode, do all the things that you normally do, visit all the websites that I always talk about, and have a nice week.
Bye-bye.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.